And my fear as a broker is overpricing and then not selling.
I'm Coulter DeVries, owner of Ranch Investor Advisory and Brokerage Services. I'm an accredited land consultant with the Realtor Land Institute and proud member of ASFMRA.
The Ranch Investor Podcast is the most downloaded and informative industry-specific content that intrigues while entertains.
All right, Cody, thanks for coming in.
Good afternoon.
Cody Cox, you are the horseshoeing broker extraordinaire.
Former horseshoer.
Former. Is brokering easier on your back?
Quite a bit better, I would say. Unless I spend a lot of time in the pickup, I think past damages are residual, and I still feel pretty bad when I have to drive very far. And got to do some mitigation there with stretching and moving around. But for the most part, yeah, I feel a lot better at night than I used to.
You're not crouched over, but you can still feel it.
Yeah, huh? That's a fact.
So what? Why jump into real estate and actually give us your background?
So my name's Cody Cox. I grew up in Southeast Wyoming, a little town called Pine Bluffs, in the 80s. Went to college there in Cheyenne for a little bit and went to horseshoeing school. Then I went to UW for a little while and decided I didn't play very well with others. So I needed to work for myself and just started shoeing horses and kind of didn't really have a direction that I was super passionate about after college. So wanted to rope and liked horses, like ranching, and figured that was a pretty good way to go about it. So I did that for quite a while. And, then I always figured out that I liked the theory of shoeing, working on lame horses and performance horses. I really enjoyed that, but the work is, for a tall, skinny guy, it makes it kind of tough. And then I really enjoyed the people. And so, I think it was suggested to me several times throughout the years that I ought to look into selling real estate. And I was like, well, it kind of sounds good, but I was moving all over the place and didn't want to be tied down. And when I got to Montana, I shod horses for another couple of years and decided I needed to do something else long-term. And that's when real estate came around.
Well, now it makes sense why you married a chiropractor.
That was a big bonus for me.
Farriers need one of those on speed dial.
Yeah, I tell you what, my hips were in pretty bad shape when I moved up here. I was locked up and had trouble, some real bad back spasms. And it took her about 6 months to a year to get that out of me to where I could function very well.
So why land in Billings or in the Billings area?
That's where my girlfriend at the time was from. She had a practice here. And so, yeah.
Because when I think of guys who rope and they maybe leverage their book of business in one business, and then they take that to real estate, like maybe you were considering, well, I've got all these horseshoeing clients. They might sell their ranch someday. Normally you monetize your home area, right? You monetize that network of where you're from, where you're established, name recognition. You have that relationship, but you had to start over clean here in Billings.
Oh yeah, definitely. I knew maybe two people, maybe half a dozen people when I moved here for sure. I got a job at Western Ranch Supply the first winter I was here. I think I worked there for about 6 months just to meet people. You know,
to pass out your real estate card. While working there you go. I should have supply.
It was a year or two before I got my license, but yeah, I should have.
So what was that experience like finding a broker that worked?
You know, I went to the real estate class. I think it lasted 7 days or a week, something like that. It was here in town. That was 2007. So it was huge. You know, everybody, it was right before the market crashed, and the class was full and
packed from wall to wall.
Oh, everybody just was like making it be an
like
agent.
The last 4 years, probably.
probably pretty similar. And I scheduled my test the day after we got out of class. So that would have been a Monday. And went and took the test, passed it, and then went hunting for a brokerage. And I got a letter from three gals and went and met with them, and they were all had just left Century 21, I think, at the time, and started their own deal, and really liked all of them, and they offered me a place there. So I went with them and been there ever since.
Well, if you started right before the crash, how did you manage to stick with it?
I'm a pretty slow learner, and I think, and so I didn't have high expectations. I kept shoeing horses. I shod horses for probably another 6 years. And that was kind of my, a lot of my business was organic from my horse shoeing business at that time.
And hoping that those team ropers would win a few so they could use you to buy a little small acreage roping arena in Shepherd, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Don't spend it on beer.
And at that time, trucks and trailers and horses aren't as expensive as they were, as they are today, relatively.
Oh, it's crazy out there now. Horses bringing, you know, 30 to 100 and who knows how much, $1,000, and, you know, pickups worth over.
So are you 70? Also a horse trader?
No.
Because, I mean, if you were a broker and a horse trader, there would be a lot of people who would be like, oh, my God, there's Cody Cox. Walk the other way.
Yeah, yeah. People would cross the street to avoid me.
Not only is he a broker, he's a horse trader.
Yeah, I've sold some horses, but I'm not very good at it. So
only the best.
I keep them if they're very good.
So, but going back to 07 and 08, that would have been difficult to be like, oh man, kind of what we're dealing with right now.
Yeah.
A lot of new licensees, and not a lot of movement out there because we have low inventory right now. Back then it was low buyer demand because of the new mortgage rates and the economy. I guess the new lending requirements back then, Dodd-Frank. How did you say, you know what, I'm just going to make this work because my back really hurts?
I think that was it. And there was no, you know, I had cash flow to sustain me, so I wasn't needing it, but it was just kind of like a bonus when I sold something. I think I sold one property the first year, or maybe the first 7 or 8 months, maybe. And and I was pretty busy just trying to learn the nuts and bolts of the business and trying to get, grow my expertise and just how to write contracts, all the legalese that we speak every day and how to do comparisons and then just getting familiar with the market. So that's what I kind of concentrated, is just working on the craft, I think, for the first probably couple of years.
Becoming proficient with the deal, becoming good at the deal.
Yeah, exactly.
And not just farming. You know, it takes a certain amount of farming, marketing to pick up new clients, but you also want to be proficient and be able to know your product, know what you're selling, and talk the talk and say, here's how I can walk you through it.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And for me, that took a little while before I felt comfortable, because I could talk, have a pretty in-depth conversation with anatomy and physiology on the lower limb of a horse. And I wasn't that adept at real estate at that point in time. So I wanted to feel that comfortable when I had a conversation about the market, what's going on locally, what's going on regionally and nationally.
Not a lot of prior similarities between horseshoeing and getting into real estate.
No. But the important part to me is the people part. You know, and that's what I enjoyed with the horseshoe. And that's why I stuck with it as long as I did, is because I really like my clients and the people I got to work with, the places I got to see, and kind of get to scratch that itch with real estate as well.
Whenever people call me and they're like, oh, I'm thinking about getting my license, what do you recommend? Where should I start? I'd like to sell ranches. Of course, I want to sell $10 million ranches is usually the leading reason. I want to sell $10 million ranches. I kind of joke half-heartedly, but kind of serious. Like, dude, if I were to do it over again, I would almost want to be a Schwann's man for the first 5 years and just work those rural routes and get those relations. Everyone loves the Schwann's man.
Oh, they're always happy to, when you show up with ice cream.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you can just transition into real estate and say, oh, here's your push pops, your maple, or not maple, but gosh dang it, what is that chocolate favorite? Malt. Here's your malt flavored push pops. And by the way, here's my card.
Yeah, that would be a pretty seamless transition, I think.
So another thing I recommend, I don't recommend, but I would consider looking back if you were to do it over. I think starting off as insurance as well, because you have to go farm, you have to go knock and ask for people's business. Selling whatever type of insurance probably be easier to sell. I shouldn't say that. It's never easy to sell anything.
Yeah.
It might be, there might be a larger market, a higher demand to sell like auto insurance and health and some of that other than life insurance and some of the bigger, more expensive type products. But I think that would be a good way to start. If you wanted to get into real estate too, is because you have all those contacts, you have an established relationship. But I think you don't see a lot of people jumping from insurance to real estate. And I think it's because that cash flow, that auto renewal comes in, man, that gets so good. It gets so easy. I shouldn't say easy again. It gets so nice to just keep building those auto renewals. Whereas in real estate, we have to go hunt it. We have to kill it, skin it, cook it every time.
You bet.
We don't get the auto renewal.
You bet. I think in my business, you know, obviously there's more probably turnover than there is in what you're dealing with big ranches. But I think that residual might come through our relationships with those people where they're willing to give us referrals of their friends and family and that they trust us. And that's kind of how I look at it is when I develop those relationships with those people that they'll come back and they will recommend me to somebody else. Because you're right. Yeah. When you start from scratch, I mean, it's a long process yet because it's a big deal. Somebody, it might be, you know, 100% of their net worth is wrapped up in their real estate sometimes. I mean, I don't recommend that, but you see that. And so that's a big ask of somebody to have them help you through that or have you help them through that transition.
Well, and when I was banking with the world's most evil corporation, Wells Fargo, at the time, John Stumpf as the CEO, Kerry Tolstedt as the CFO, during the pressure cooker environment that everyone knows about, remembers of Wells Fargo stock, the model was changing. And it's not like as a banker, you were just a credit officer or a relationship manager or a loan officer. You actually had to go out there and get new clients. That was part of the new model of banking. The old guys hated it because the old guys, they used to bank from 9 till about 3 in the afternoon, you know, take a long lunch. And about 3, they would open up the whiskey and completely different model. So it was sales in the sense that we were selling money.
Sure.
So we had to learn how to do CRM. Wells Fargo had an extensive proprietary CRM system. And I'm curious. So my sales training with Wells Fargo, when I was essentially selling money, we had to work centers of influence. So attorneys, insurance, and leaders of the Elks Club or,
sure,
or some organization. You had to work your community leaders, and say we had to do like 3 a week, and then you had to have like 10 direct solicitations a week. Do you have a model like that in your business where how much do you focus on centers of influence and direct outreach?
You know, I'm starting to implement that a little bit more. Call it my strategic partners are probably a good way to think about it, but they're just other small businesses that I utilize and I want to promote. So I take them out to my sphere. I'm just starting that. I just, in my monthly newsletter, I just included one small business and he's actually a home inspector that just had bought another business and he tried to do some value add with my monthly newsletter. So that's something new that I'm trying. You know, I'm always looking for sources of referrals, you know. So I think that's what you're speaking to is, you know,
Yeah.
And so I'm always thinking about that with other, I look at it as my past clients are probably my primary focus in that regard, but I also am trying to, you know, network with other small businesses that I utilize, you know, so I know what they are, how they work, and that I can be trusted to recommend them to my people. And then, you know, hopefully we'll get some, I bring some value to them, and hopefully they can refer people back to me.
It's funny how many high performing brokers use the stick it note as their CRM. So when
I've got stick it notes everywhere.
Oh man. Or the back of the envelope.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I've got a lot of those too. Drives my wife nuts.
When I was at Realtor Land Institute, has their annual convention a couple of years ago, they had a CRM guy talking about, you got to figure out a process. You got to implement a process and stick to it and work that CRM, stay organized, stay neat, stay clean, stay diligent. And it's, he said, by show of hands, how many people here are still using post-it notes? And you know, there's plenty of guys in their 50s and 60s and 40s. These are all high performing brokers. They're like looking left, looking right. Yeah, I still use post-it notes. But there is, I mean, it's true. I had a long road trip with a estate planner. We drove 4 hours to meet with one of my clients and one way. And so I got to hear his craft and he got to sharpen my pencil quite a bit. And he's probably one of the most successful estate planners in Billings. So he sells those high commission products like life insurance and annuities and all those things that go into retirement, death, succession, all that stuff. And he was saying, I've just stuck to the plan of 20 outreaches a week and like 10 follow-ups and 3 in-person meetings. So it's like a 20-10-3, he called it. Something towards that effect. And obviously it's worked for him. He's been highly successful doing a 20-10-3. 20 new, 10 follow-ups, 3 in-person.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be nice if we were that disciplined?
Well, I've not done that for a long time, right? And here a couple of years ago, I decided I needed some better processes. So I've been trying to implement that. So I have developed something similar to that, and it's been helpful, and I've been able to stay in contact with people that, you know, maybe I haven't reached out to in a long time. And then the people I've recently sold things to, I'm in really good contact with them. And yeah, I just needed a system in place, because if we're not in front of them, they forget about us pretty quick.
Yeah. And I think that kind of goes back to, you and I were talking on the phone the other day, what makes a successful brokerage or real estate business? And if you look at any small town, America probably has 2 or 3 50, 60, even 70 year old brokers. They sell residential, lots and land, farm and ranch, some commercial, some business, some development, some recreation. And in any small town America, that those 2 or 3 brokers, they're not living in a manufactured home. They're not driving an old jalopy vehicle. They're doing very well. So it's almost like the proven model. And that's part of the reason, because people see them at the post office and the bar.
Oh, absolutely.
And the basketball games and the football games. And they know who to reach out to. They know who to talk to. But that proven model, it also has risk management in there through up cycles, down cycles. There's if they have the competence to sell those different assets, they're like the clearinghouse for that local area.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth to that.
And that, I don't want to make recommendations, but if you wanted to be successful at this business in a small town, go to a small town and sell it all and stay active in your community, and you'll never be in a manufactured home.
Yeah, you'll do very well. And that's great for those brokers, but it's a double-edged sword, because I think a lot of times they can get pretty complacent too. And the clients have limited options when they want to buy or sell something, in terms of competency of that broker, because what's the incentive for them to improve and get better?
Yeah. And who's the competition? Who's checking their numbers and their timelines, their opinions?
Yeah. I think there's
CMAs.
There's 1,300 agents in Billings, you know, the town of 100 and some thousand people, you know, that's quite a few.
What kind of variance do you think would happen, say Billings, where there's more licenses than listings, and you can turn to, you know, your cousin has a license, your neighbor mm-hmm. has a license, your hairdresser has a license. You can get three CMAs. What do you think the variance is? Is there going to be a 20% difference in opinion?
Of the suggested price?
Yes.
I don't know. That's a good question. I would think agents are just people, right? And so there's a spectrum, and there's going to be people that really need that listing, and they might try to offer a higher price than maybe the data is suggesting if they think that the seller wants to hear it. I mean, everybody wants to hear that their stuff's worth more than it really is. And there's some brokers that they might contact that are doing well, and then they'll give them the realistic price. Say, hey, it's worth X, and take it or leave it. They'd love to have the business, but they don't need to have it. You know, their mortgage payment doesn't depend on it next month. And that, I think that leads to brokers really varying probably on that price, you know, trying to, because when you're coming from a place of I need to have it, the conversation's different, you know.
Absolutely.
I really need this. So yeah. So I don't know.
I need this.
Yeah, exactly.
Did I ever learn a lesson when I got a tattoo from a guy who said, God, dude, I need the money. Eventually I need to go get that tattoo redone.
Yeah, I might have to have a laser treatment.
Well, this sounds like another conversation. I would imagine the broker who's doing well, who gives the CMA or the BPO that's accurate, they don't quite deliver as take it or leave it.
Correct.
And then also going into the conversation, the new agent who says, I really need this listing, either internally, I can't imagine too many people say that explicitly. They might say it internally, but you and I have been talking about negotiating Chris Voss.
Correct.
And what are his books that we talk about? It's Never Split the Difference.
Never Split the Difference.
How has that helped you in your business?
I think when I'm trying to implement his principles, I think it's made me a better listener, because I'm actively trying to listen and understand what the people are really trying to say. A lot of times people will want something and they don't really want to say it out loud, or I want to get to what their motivations are to best help them. Because a lot of times people don't even know what they want, or they're unfamiliar with the market. I'm sure you run into that, and these amenities for that they want for X price just doesn't exist. And so, yeah, I'm looking for a way in to kind of help them get to where I think ultimately they want to be.
Doesn't that go right in the face of a negotiation, in that you're negotiating with the client for the listing, you're trying to figure out their motivations, but then you have someone like me at a open house with his wife saying, do not show how much you like this. Kind of like car shopping. Don't let the salesman know how much you like this. We don't want you to know our motivation.
Sure.
Isn't that just generally like, I don't want to tell this broker my motivation or what my bottom number is?
Yeah, if you're across the table versus being on the same side of the table, you know, if they're your client versus another broker's client, yeah, that's always kind of the rub. But I think, yeah, at an open house scenario, for sure. Like if they like, oh, we really like this house, but
shh, don't say that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But if they want it, if it's priced accordingly, you know, they're going to, I think that's probably part of the reason why they're there. If they're generally interested in the area and the price, they wouldn't be there if it was overpriced. Right. And, you know, I don't know.
Now, when you say across the table or on the same side, when you're going into a listing agreement, that is a negotiation, you're negotiating mm-hmm. listing price and commission and duration, time on the market.
Correct.
How do you get to the same side as the table, same side of the table, to where they trust you, you've built rapport, they respect you as a professional? How do you get there so that it's not combative, that I say listed at three, you say four, I want 18 months, you want 12. I want 8% commission, you want 2% commission.
Sure, sure. And I think that's where being genuinely interested in what they have to say and where they're coming from. And I think that's what gets back to the listening part, because, you know, maybe they want that and it's not realistic. So why are they saying that? Where are they coming from? Say maybe they have a $500,000 house that they want $750,000. All right, we're way off. That's not going to sell for that. So why do you think, first of all, why do you think it's worth that? And they can give you reasons. And then if they're valid reasons, then maybe you need to look at your own price that you put on the property versus the information that I'm, hopefully I'll have more information than they do, especially concerning price. Then maybe I can bring some facts and say, I appreciate what you're saying, but this is what the facts are telling me. This is what places have actually sold for. That's kind of the beauty of us living in a non-disclosure state too. A lot of people look at listing prices and they don't get to see sold prices. So we can come armed with some actual information of what happened, how many days on market, different things. But it gets back to their motivations. Maybe they don't care. Maybe they don't care if they sell the next 3 or 4 years or buy, you know, and then you can kind of attack those problems as they come up. But you don't find that out until you have a real conversation with them.
Well, this sounds intense. You're using the words come armed and attack.
I never want to sound like that.
I'm immediately defensive.
That's true.
So how do you get people's defenses down if that's even the right way of looking at
it? Yeah, I shouldn't say that.
Especially when you have to, sometimes you do have to invalidate them and say, you know what? I see what you're saying. You have a beautiful place. You put a lot of work into it. But I just don't see the numbers working out for you. Mm-hmm. How do you invalidate someone gently?
I try to do it with facts and then ask them, pointed questions as to why they feel that way. Why, you know, this is what the numbers are showing me, and say I have two comparables that are pretty good information, and they come at me and it turns into more of what they're feeling they think the place ought to be worth. Yeah. So sometimes I'll leave it at that and revisit it a time later, or say, you know, we can list it high if you want, but it's probably not going to sell, you know, and these are the reasons why. I just try to get down. I want to be with them through the process. I'm not trying to be adversarial towards them. And sometimes it doesn't work out. Sometimes, you know, they want more than I think than the market will bear, and I can choose to walk away, or they can choose to walk away with me. But I'm hoping when I sit down at the table with them, I've built up enough trust where they trust what they want me there. They called me. So hopefully I can, through my advice, they're willing to believe me.
Do you have to use explicit labels such as, Tom, I am not your enemy?
I've never done that. Thank goodness.
Help me help you. I am your friend here, Tom. Put your dukes down. I am not your enemy. How do you label, and how do you explicitly get that point across that you are there in their best interest?
Well, for one, we're entering into a fiduciary role, meaning that we have to legally put their interests in front of ours in terms of the transaction. So at a bare minimum, we enter into the agreement like this is our position, this is our relationship, if we choose to go forward. So it's my duty to tell you that what the market value is for this house. Hopefully it doesn't come like the example you gave. Hopefully it doesn't get that adversarial. Hopefully I've, you know, headed that off way before then. But yeah, to label specific things. I don't know. I haven't really thought about that, in terms of how I would handle a situation like that.
I I'm going to make a broad generalization here, but okay. I would say dealing with small rural acreage, residential, lots and more recreational consumer properties probably has less of that because there's less of a variance in opinion. Whereas ranches are trading like art. It's a collector item. And that is very subjective. And yes, there is a market range, but everyone knows that one man's junk is another man's treasure. And when it's so subjective, there could be another 30% left on the table if you don't. That's the fear. If you don't price it 50% over what the market's doing, how much are you leaving on the table? And so that does become very combative and adversarial. That no, I see what you're saying. You do have a great place. However, the probability of you stretching the market that far is very low.
Yeah. And the word you used there was fear. And so I might, in that particular situation, I might key in on their fear that they might be missing out or undersell by 30% for sure. Yeah.
Fear of leaving money on the table is a huge one. It's probably, gosh, it's one of the biggest fears out there.
Yep. And my fear as a broker is overpricing and then not selling.
Right? Yes. Yeah. Wasting your time, money, and effort. Mm-hmm. And I would say with residential, the fear of leaving $5,000 on the table, although I guess I do need to empathize that most of these homes are their largest asset, right? Just like a ranch is a rancher's largest
asset. For sure.
Yeah. So $5,000 on a $500,000 home, 1%. Well, it's hard for me to gauge that. What the level of fear and resistance based on fear of loss rather than opportunity for gain.
Correct. Yeah. And the other thing to take into consideration with just purchase price is just one of the variables with or sales price. You know, you have your depending on the age of the house, and even a new home or new place is inspections, you know, that can beat you up worse than the purchase price or a price reduction in a lot of cases.
And there's so much more data to defend opinions, BPOs and CMAs.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
It takes the subjectivity out of it.
It helps for sure. Yeah. Especially in neighborhoods that are got a lot of activity in them. It's, you can get kind of dialed down to a square footage price and be pretty darn close if your condition is even in the ballpark.
So other than reading Chris Voss, Never Split the Difference, what else do you do to improve your business?
You know, I focus a lot on, I would say, just self-improvement, something that interests me. So I try to do things like control my diet, my exercise, things that are going in, kind of just puts me in a better mood and a better ability to serve my clients, because this business can kind of be an emotional roller coaster, you know. So try to do hard things, and then the day-to-day stuff seems to go by the wayside a little bit easier, you know. I like it when bad things happen. It can be like water off a duck's back, you know. I do time restricted eating. I've done that for a long time. That was very difficult for me to start off doing that. But I've been doing it about 7 years now, and that's been been very good beneficially, both health wise. And then it's painful every day. So, you know, I get used to that pain and, makes other things easier. I do cold water immersion. I've been doing that for a couple of years now, and that's been, sucks every morning, but
when you were a beer drinking rope and cowboy, did you have any idea how much discipline you're going to be getting into and feelings, dealing with other people's feelings and hand holding? And
no,
it's like you're a shrink.
Yeah, it's something that I didn't see coming.
Beer drinking rope and cowboys don't often strike me as good shrinks.
No, we're not. Sometimes I think I am, but then, yeah, turns out I'm not.
And then not just a shrink for your client to help them through their emotions, but as you mentioned, the roller coasters of your own business. And
yeah. Yeah. And if I can't help anybody else, if I'm working on myself all the time, you know, and always in peril and worried about things and high anxiety and whatever daily things come through, I got to have my own ship kind of right before I can help anybody else. So that's kind of what I focus on.
Calling them up, screaming at them, just sign the listing agreement. I need this.
I need this. Yeah, exactly. Cause like a lot of things, I think this business can bring the best out of you and it can bring the worst out of you. And you just got to be cognizant of that.
Well, especially if you're hangry all the time.
Yeah.
Man, how do you cope with that and kids at the same time?
Oh, yeah. If you can do that, you can do anything, right?
That just sounds like you need another cocktail to numb the pain. I'm going to do cold bath, but I'm also going to take painkillers. I'm going to do time eating regimen, but I'm also going to consume edibles to take my... That just sounds like it could spin out of control very quickly for the wrong person.
Oh, I bet it could. Yeah, but I tell you what, struggling through things is important for all of us, I think. And if I can kind of craft my own struggles, that then maybe I won't have to deal with the ones that... Or I'll be better at dealing with the ones that I can't choose. Because if I like the saying, the worst thing you've ever experience is the worst thing that you've ever experienced. So if you experience really crappy things every day, you know, it's not that big a deal.
Do you study stoicism? This sounds a lot like stoic philosophy.
I've heard it. You know, another thing that's, I've spent a lot of time working on my faith probably the last five or six years, and that's been really important to me. And
so prayer, meditation, another.
Yeah.
Another regimen.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Read the Bible every morning, first thing. Yeah, it helps.
Keeps you humble.
I need that. I've got jiu-jitsu for that, so I get smashed.
Oh, my goodness. So cold baths, starvation, the Bible, prayer, meditation, and jiu-jitsu. Do you have time to be out selling?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that's why I needed systems, because doesn't come naturally to me, so I need to work on time blocks when I can do this different stuff. And because it's important. I think it came to me later in life. Well, a lot of that stuff didn't exist, you know, years ago when I probably could have really used it, but better late than never, I guess.
If only we could have started when we were 20, huh?
I know, right?
What was the old saying that beauty is wasted on the youth? It's kind of like if only I had the wisdom of a 36-year-old, which I am, when I was 26.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've probably got the wisdom. I'm 48 now, so I probably have the wisdom of a maybe 30-year-old by now. So I'm hoping.
It's going to be fun when we have teenage girls, huh?
I'll know what not to do, I think, or how not to guide them.
So what does the average day look like for you? You got cold bath in the morning, prayer, meditation in the morning.
Yeah. So typically, I'll get up, make some coffee, read my Bible, and I'm usually into a book. So that's about 15 minutes.
Is this a professional book? Is this honing your skills, or is this?
Yeah, always. I don't enjoy it. Abstract. So okay. Yeah. And so that's what I need to do. I don't really read for fun, but it's not terrible. You know, I enjoy some of the books I'm reading, and for sure, I always get something out of all of them. So then I get that going. Then about then my wife's getting out of the shower, so it's time to get the kids up, get them ready for school. And either a couple days a week, my daughter's 4, so she stays with me a couple days a week. So on those days, I don't get much done in terms of prospecting. I can do some computer work, and maybe if I have showings or things like that, I can schedule for then. And then the other days a week, I'll take her to daycare, come back, do a cold bath at that time. Like some savages do it right when they jump out of bed. And I do every once in a while, but not very often. I have to work up to it. I have to talk myself into it every day. And I've got a neighbor that comes over now, and he's been doing it with me. And so there's a lot more people that are doing it. I did it by myself pretty much for a year and a half. And so, but it's kind of fun doing it with other people, watching the utter pain on their face. I enjoy it. Then I'll usually grab a workout and then, have a time block for calls and note cards to people and prospecting, whatever activities I'm involved in that day. And then whatever transactions I've got going on, and then sometimes I'll go meet people for coffee or try to have lunch with people 2 or 3 days a week. And that's fulfilling to me. I need to be around people. I really enjoy the conversations. Sometimes it's about business. Sometimes it's not, but,
part of the business fills your tank. It's that interaction with other people does feel rewarding. It gets you going.
Definitely. Definitely. That's why, COVID was hard on me. You know, I had a baby at the time and I was pretty isolated for a couple of years there anyways, just because of the function of having a child at home. And, you know, since I work out of the home and my wife doesn't, I was in de facto was taking care of the kid most of the time and, or a good part of the time anyways. And when everybody else was working and yeah, it took me a while to figure out really that I was just, missed the interaction of other people. So I really appreciate it now. It's not lost on me, that I get to make money, you know, being around people that I really enjoy. So
yeah, that's part of my story. Why there wasn't a lot of love lost when I left the ranch was because I was by myself with my dog all day long. And it was changing water, fixing water and fencing by myself. And I mean, there's immense beauty and reward and pleasure in that. I was under the Beartooth, big Montana skies, out in nature, exercise, staying active, all that's great. But I was by myself all day long. And that's why there wasn't a lot of love lost when I left.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can relate with that too. I always thought where I grew up, my uncle had a place and we had some cows. And I always thought, man, it'd be cool to go to big ranch and country and just disappear and be by myself all the time. Just cowboy. It's like, that sounds really cool to me. And as I got older in the wintertime, every once in a while, probably in my 20s, I went and helped some friends, calve cows. And we were out there quite a ways and, they were really good friends of mine, but in this little town that nobody was or even close to me, it was like 50 miles to town, 60 miles to town. And all of a sudden I figured out I didn't like being out on the ranch that far by myself.
Yeah. And after Paul Harvey died, I didn't have him on the radio anymore to look forward to.
Yeah. It was a rough one.
So Paul Harvey was my only friend for a while.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't realize how much I needed that until I didn't have it, you know?
So what are you working for? Why do all this discipline? Why have this regimental structure and schedule? Do you have a mission, vision, and value statement? Do you have BHAG, big, hairy, audacious goal? What's your why?
I think because I need it. I'm not real formal in terms of writing goals down. That's something I'm working on.
You have a coach for that, right?
I do. Yeah.
So you even have a professional personal business coach, which for some people it's their pastor or their counselor in some capacity. But it sounds like you have a specialized business coach or life coach.
Yeah. No, not life coach, but business coach. But yeah. And I think a lot of that.
Why?
I think I need the accountability.
But why are you going through that effort? Why do you think you need the accountability?
To see my business grow.
Why do you want to see your business grow?
I think because if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. And I think if you're not growing, you're atrophying and you're not using it. I think it's more of a philosophical thing for me. Like, of course, you'd always want to make more money and do better and provide more things for your family. But at the end of the day, for me, none of that stuff drives me a lot. I mean, I'm not real big on things and stuff. But experience is really important to me. I just want to be better. I guess is maybe the reason behind it for my family.
Yeah. You will know the tree by the fruit it bears. Is that a Bible verse?
Yeah. I don't know if that's a Bible verse. Sounds like one.
So you're trying to try the fruit you're bearing is for the family, the tree, the roots.
Yeah. Yeah. And then community, I think we have a obligation. We live around other people and we need to contribute. We can't just be passive and just be takers. I'm not comfortable with that. You know, I like to serve, I like to help people out. I think deep down, I have a easy time empathizing with people that have problems, you know, that are having trouble in their life. And I think it wasn't really conscious, but I started doing some of this stuff and one thing leads to another. And I'm like, I can't help anybody else if I can't help myself. I think was maybe the impetus that got me going down this track. So.
Well, you're a very, empathetic rodeo cowboy. That's an anomaly. Again, painting with broad brushes.
Broad brushes. Correct.
Well, Cody Cox, we're coming up to the outro here, the last 10 minutes or so.
Oh, that was quick.
Yeah. It goes fast when you're having a good time, kind of like life.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks for coming on. Do you have any burning desires here to talk about, to share? To clear up any of my fallacies or misconceptions?
You know, not really. I don't think so. I think we
busting my stereotypes.
No, I think you're probably right on at the rodeo cowboy stuff. Yeah, we could just talk about real estate a little bit. What's going on there in terms of
what is going on? What's your crystal ball say? I guess that is my running question I ask everyone. What's the crystal ball?
Yeah, I think their interest rates, by all the experts that I listen to, are supposed to be going down this year. So that's going to help the market, I think. And people that are sitting on the fence, I think it'll be able to knock some people off the fence when things get a little bit more desirable. You know, hopefully we get, from what I've heard, second, third quarter this year, they're going to start backing off even more. They're pretty volatile right now. And I think that's going to be, in the short term, they're going to be all over the place. And yeah, hopefully that helps with our inventory problem that we're dealing with, because there's a lot of new buyers coming on the market, and there's a lot of baby boomers that are retiring and possibly moving down. So yeah, there's going to be a lot of activity here the next couple of years.
Price is going to continue to climb.
They're pretty steady right now, but yeah, I mean, I think simple supply demand economics, if there's more demand than there's supply, prices are going to go up. So time will tell.
But yeah, it doesn't sound good to me. It sounds like, because we still have a lot of transactions happening, a lot of pending. Mm-hmm. The absorption rate is not, it hasn't tipped into a buyer's market. It's still a pretty quick absorption rate. And yet we're at, what, 7.6 for a 30-year mortgage or something like that with good credit?
Yeah.
So if that goes down, we're already at low inventory levels. Prices have to adjust higher. Mm-hmm. As you said, a broadening buyer pool. Man, that just doesn't sound good for buyers like myself right now.
Yeah, first-time home buyers are, it's tough. It's tough. And
fortunately, if you have the asset, we are on the fence, because we have the asset, we can wait, but I think it's just going to be super rough for anyone looking for a while.
I think you're absolutely right. So, yeah. So, and you're starting to see it, and you have seen it a little bit in the residential market with how things really, because when the faucet turned off, it really turned off. Like, it was crazy, multiple offer situations to almost, you know, just nothing. Mm-hmm. And then 60 days on the market, just almost overnight. And, but I would say right now it feels to me, obviously not when I started in the business in 2007, but probably in the 2010s when the recovery kind of happened, it seems like kind of like a typical type market, you know, in terms of days on market and appreciation and things. So yeah, I hope demand isn't too high, just so we can help these people find a place where they want to be, you know. And but like you say, you're on one side of the fence or the other. Like, it's great for if you're selling, Maybe not so good if you're buying.
Yeah, it's really good if you have two homes and you can sell one.
Yeah, for sure.
That's the ideal situation, is have that one in the chamber.
But I don't like to make predictions, because I thought in late 2019, early 2020, I thought things had kind of peaked and it was going to level off, and I was couldn't have been more wrong. So
I hear you. Well, Cody, thanks for coming on. Appreciate your time here.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Click subscribe on your streaming platform so you know when the latest episode has dropped.